This episode includes details of murder scenes, including unsettling descriptions of murder, sexual acts, body mutilation, and post-mortem, as well as the aftermath experienced by victims of attempted murder who survived and shared details of their attacks, which may be particularly distressing for some listeners. As such, listener discretion is firmly advised.
AIDS brings a response Life from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims lives.
Welcome to AIDS The Lost Voices.
With your camp host, William Hampson.
And my fabulous co-host, Marty.
Between us, we'll be looking back through the decades at how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic.
And where we will try to unpick individual stories in the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties. Ready?
Ready.
All right, let's do it. So, if you've listened before, you might have heard from the intro that Gloria won't be joining us for this mini-series, and in these two episodes regarding Michelle Lupo, I was going to be joined by the ladies from the HIV podcast, given they did a fantastic job on their crime mini-series. However, due to technical difficulties and a clashing diaries, we just couldn't come together. However, Marty, a friend of mine, came to the rescue, and here he is.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me on here, Will.
Yeah. You're welcome. Well, actually, just to kind of butt in there, we did have plans. We discussed about you coming on, and we were going to do a long-term survivors episode, and we were going to talk about your status. But given the two ladies from the HIV podcast, we just couldn't come together. I actually think, because, you know, they've been nominated for so many awards, I just think that they thought this was below them.
And
I think, you know, people do get like that sometimes, don't they? They get these big egos. And I think, you know, their egos are through the roof. I mean, this is just between me and you. You know, I won't put this into the episode.
Yeah.
I will. So check out the brilliant HIV podcast. So thank you for coming to the rescue and helping us out.
You're welcome.
We've turned it into four episodes, a mini-series, and hopefully we'll be back again in January next year with another series.
With another series, I am so excited. I've enjoyed every minute of doing this podcast with you.
We haven't started yet.
Oh, no.
So on that note, shall we get started?
Am I supposed to say something there?
Yeah, like, come on then. Let's do it.
Come on then, Will. Let's do it.
Oh, the enthusiasm is amazing. Right, guys, let's go.
Lupo went cruising round London's well-known homosexual haunts looking for partners in casual sex. He'd pick them up and take them to derelict buildings or alleyways, but in a two-month period last year, he murdered three of his pickups and tried to kill two others.
Disturbingly, he picked up two of them at the Colhern pub in Earl's Court, but it was in this pub in May 1986 that attack survivor David Cole led undercover detectives to Lupo.
The murders shocked London's gay community. Police said Lupo's life sentence would help relieve the anxiety.
Police were literally looking for a needle in a haystack, but with the help of one man and the gay community at large, they found their killer.
Police believe he realised he had AIDS, then took revenge on homosexuals.
Over the next two episodes, Marty and I will examine the harrowing events of Michelle Lupo, who murdered several men in London in 1986. Lupo's appalling crimes gained international attention, partly due to his HIV/AIDS diagnosis, but in recent years, it is evident that the narrative surrounding this series of murder has been severely distorted. In recent years, drag queens, bloggers and podcasters have sensationalised and glamorised Lupo's actions with disregard for the lives of the victims, often misrepresenting the details of their deaths and, in many cases, getting their names wrong altogether. This misinterpretation not only obscures the truth, but also diminishes the tragic reality of the young men whose lives were so tragically cut short. In this episode, we will focus on the factual accounts of these victims, ensuring to keep their identities and tragic stories distinct from those of Lupo himself, with a deeper analysis of his profile to follow in the next episode. So, to start with, I should explain I made a Freedom of Information request to the Metropolitan Police for access to the case files, assuming they might still exist, and that they'd let little nobody me have a butcher's, unlikely, but worth a shot. However, my request was denied, which, to be fair, I had anticipated. In their response, they outlined the considerable effort required to process my inquiry, where they stated...
To give you an idea of the volume of work involved following initial searches, this returned in excess of 15 boxes that would need to be carefully read in order to ascertain if any information could be disclosed, what exemptions that may need to be cited, etc. Each of these boxes are approximately 4 inches thick, So potentially there could be thousands of pieces of paper, photos, etc. that would need to be viewed.
Oh, that's a lot, isn't it? 15 boxes at 4 inches thick.
15 boxes, that's like going to take you a while, isn't it?
Isn't it? And they did go on to share, reviewing such a substantial amount of documentation would be at considerable time and cost, which I accept to be a fair decision. However, before all this GDPR red tape, Tim Tate and Ray Wire, both seasoned professionals in documentary making and investigative journalism, had unrestricted access to all the police files on this case. In 1992, they followed up this visual narrative on a fly-on-a-wall crime documentary for ITV with a book titled Murder Squad, which I have here. And within it, they detailed the case of Michele Lupo. The authors not only included insights gleaned from police files, but also incorporated poignant quotes from witness statements. So, if me and Marty refer to the book, this is what we're referring to as the source.
It's funny because I don't even remember like Murder Squad on the TV, like back in the day.
No, you'd definitely remember it. I wouldn't.
Yeah, because I'd have been 22 in 1992. I'd have been 22. You'd have been 12, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I'd have been watching Ragged Dolls and the one.
Yeah, boys. Rosie and Jim and all right. That. Yeah.
I think they
just. I must have been out clubbing at the time. That's all I can say. If it was late at night, I would have been out clubbing. But yeah, it's interesting to see what they said.
So one of the first reports in the press was on the 17th of March, 1986, where many newspapers ran the headline, Body Found. But most, like the Belfast Newsletter newspaper, went with, quote, man battered. And it reads,
the battered body of a man in his 30s was found yesterday by squatters in a derelict basement flat opposite London's Earls Court Exhibition Centre. Police investigating the murder were last night questioning members of the area's homosexual community.
Given murder and death was common in a metropolitan city such as London, sadly, the press was slow to take up the murder of this young man. However, we eventually learn that this man is James George Burns, better known to all who knew him as Jim. He was originally from Edinburgh in Scotland and born on the 9th of September 1949, making him 36 years old at the time of his death. He lived in Leytonstone, East London, and worked as a railway guard at London's Liverpool Street station. Jim was a gay man, described as a gentle giant given his above-average height and build. And given Earl's Court in the 1980s was a mecca for gay nightlife, Jim, like most gay men, were drawn to places like the Colhern Pub to socialise with other like-minded gay men. Investigating officers, desperate for leads, asked radio DJ and TV entertainer Kenny Everett if he could make a public appeal 6 days after Jim's murder while opening a shop around the corner from the murder scene. The article reads,
Kenny Everett has offered to help detectives desperate for clues to a brutal homosexual murder by a killer with a lust for blood. TV and radio personality offered to make an appeal for witnesses who may have seen 36-year-old train guard Mr. James Burns before he was battered, strangled and dumped in a derelict basement. His leather-clad body was found in Warwick Road last Sunday. Detectives think he met his death in the course of a homosexual act. Can you see my eye roll? A Scotland Yard spokesman said, he kindly agreed to help us by asking anyone who might have seen Mr. Burns on the night he died to come forward. Today, the man leading the murder hunt, Detective Chief Superintendent Jim Begg, said of the killer, this person is a maniac. He has a lust for blood. Mr. Burns had been socialising in the area and we are desperate for witnesses.
Oh, already, see, so early on they're sensationalising it, aren't they?
Well, it's typical of the press at the time, isn't it? Well, it's typical of the press anyway, over-sensationalising a murder.
It makes you wonder if there is that sense of there's a lack of sympathy there as such.
Yeah, I do kind of get that feeling, Will, because it's like, it's because of this homosexual act.
He's gay, yeah.
Yeah, that he's got murdered.
Mm.
The appeals by Kenny and the police, mixed in with local reporting of the murder of Jim, lead to a man coming forward. The Wolverhampton Express reports the witness coming forward with headline, Murder Attempt by Guard Strangler. And it reads,
the Earl's Court Strangler, see they're giving him a label already, aren't they? Who yeah. killed train guard Mr. James Burns, almost certainly tried to murder another man a few days earlier, detectives said today. He picked up his first victim in the same pub, the Colhern, where Mr. Burns had been drinking on the night before he died. He attacked the man in the same derelict basement flat where Mr. Burns, from Leytonstone, was found dead by two squatters. The man, who the police say could still be in danger, can remember little about the attack, but he had neck injuries, marks on his throat and bloodshot eyes. Detectives have little doubt that an attempt was made to murder him.
The article goes on to describe the suspect, who we know to be Lupo, given by this witness. He's aged between 25 and 30, white, 5'11", clean-shaven with dark collar-length hair. He's slim and said to have unusually long legs. At the time of the attack, he was wearing Levi 501 type jeans and a black leather zip-up jacket, possibly with a gold motif on the left shoulder. He wore a glove on his left hand. The earlier victim, who police have not named, met his attacker in the Colhern the previous Monday night. He went with him to the basement flat in Warwick Road and lost consciousness after the attack. For the time, I suppose, I mean, he did notice a lot about the attacker, which is good.
And Tate and Wire shared in their book from intelligence gathered by the police that the man who came forward after surviving an attack by Lupo is 31-year-old Kevin McDonough. He lived in Wood Green, London, and was one of six children from Clonmel Island. Hope I pronounced that right. He gained a degree in biology in 1976 and came to London the same year to study and worked in an osteopath clinic in Wimbledon. The book shares how Kevin had come to encounter Lupo, where it states, as he sat in the Colhern that Monday, he alternatively filled in the crossword in the Evening Standard and sipped at his pint of Tennent Strong Lager. It was a ritual he performed on each visit before adjourning to his habitual station at the back of the pub near the ladies' toilet. By 9:30 p.m, he had rejected the advances of one man and succumbed to the attraction of another. Michele Lupo was dressed in his regular attire, black leather bomber jacket, blue sweatshirt and dark blue Levi jeans with a black leather glove hanging out of the back pocket.
In the complicated sign language of the homosexual community, the glove and its position carried a message. It told experienced observers that its bearer enjoyed the sadistic side of sadomasochistic sex. Kevin McDonough was fascinated. I have never heard of the black glove. It was always handkerchief codes. Back in the day, you know, and obviously which colour handkerchief in which side of the back pocket meant different things. This is new to me, the black leather glove. Maybe somebody may enlighten us, but I have never heard of it before.
When I looked into the colour coding, because it was slightly before my time, is that the black handkerchief, or whether you used a black glove, it was it was signalling just like light S&M, you know. I think a lot of times I saw that it just stated, you know, a little bit of slapping and whipping. I mean, yeah. The police here or the press saying that it was signalling an extreme form of sadomasochistic sex, I think, to be disingenuous and untrue.
Oh, well, that you know, the police and the press are going to have a field day, ain't they? You know, that's basically what it is. And of course, I'm going to say it's like the worst possible derogatory thing that anybody could get involved with, because
especially the gays.
It was a gay man, so it's got to be the worst case scenario ever. And that always happened in the press in the 80s and 90s, you know.
And it's almost kind of letting the reader know that, well, you know, Kevin and the other men that we're going to discuss, you know, they kind of deserved it because they knew what they were getting into.
Oh yeah, it's like pointing to, oh, what they was doing was absolutely degrading anyway, so the inevitability of it was going to end in tears.
Yeah.
And
do we know what Kevin said in his statement to the police?
We do. Kevin said, I was attracted to him. Shortly after, he said, did I want to come back with him to his place? I said, yes. We didn't discuss sex or anything like that. It was obvious he was gay. We didn't need to discuss it. We left the pub, turned left, crossed diagonally across Old Brompton Road, and then across Warwick Road towards the tube station. And Kevin went on to state that Lupo showed no emotion, no excitement on their brief walk from the Colhern pub to the derelict house on Warwick Road. Kevin was directed by Lupo down the iron steps to the basement flat of 32 Warwick Road, which is a terrace right beside Earl's Court tube station.
And interestingly, I looked into the history of 32 Warwick Road, which still exists today. It was then a three-story terrace, four if you include the basement. And in the early 1960s, it was granted planning permission for a change of use to an alcoholics outpatient centre. Then it was student accommodation, then hostel accommodation, and like most of Warwick Road, it became a small hotel. By the time of these attacks in 1986, the property had been vacated and work had started to convert the basement into a two-bedroom flat and bed sits on the upper floors. But after work started, the planning application was denied, so work came to a halt. Given it was literally a building site, that's why they referred to it as being derelict. Now, the two squatters they mentioned earlier and referred to later have been allowed to squat, on the understanding they keep the building secure and commence work, because they were builders, when permission was finally granted. Because in the 1980s, there was a massive shortage of work, men were coming to London from all over the UK, and given the shortage of jobs, work like this was fiercely defended, hence why these two men are no doubt willing to live in horrible conditions as they did on effectively a building site.
And we get to hear what it was like in the basement from Kevin's statement to the police, where he states, "It was very dark. I was down there before I realised it was derelict. I'm not very sure of what happened next. I know we went there to have sex, but I know that we didn't. I certainly wasn't buggered and I didn't masturbate. I remember coming..." That's a vile word, isn't it? Buggered. Jesus Christ. Right.
But it was quite common then. It seemed to be like the correct word to use.
Yeah, it did.
It's written
actually
everywhere.
Okay, I didn't masturbate. I remember coming in, that threw me off, though. I remember coming into this little room where my clothing was in position and my flies done up. I was groggy, but not really in pain. I didn't know where I was at first and I staggered upstairs. Was he drugged then, Will?
I don't think so, no. I mean, he did state that he was drinking Tennent's strong lager.
Which I presume is Tennent's super at the time.
Yeah, probably. And that's quite a heavy drink, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And we heard from the article earlier that Kevin didn't report this attack to the police.
Sadly, he didn't. This was due to the mistrust between the gay community and the police at the time. Kevin recalls as he left the basement at 12:15, an hour after he went down there with Lupo. As he staggers onto the pavement at Warwick Road, he bumps into two uniformed police constables, and the book states, "PC Stephen Lewis and Stephen Shipton could not have known it, but in this chance encounter lay the first tangible evidence of what was to become a trial of serial murder. To them, Kevin McDonough was just another Irish drunk who had apparently collapsed unconscious in a derelict basement. Neither officer gave it much thought."
Man.
Yeah, well.
It makes you wonder, really, would that have happened today if they saw someone staggering out? I think they'd be detained and questioned extensively.
Yeah, I think that'd be a bit more on it. I mean, you know, I understand that why Kevin didn't report the attack to the police, because at that time, Kevin, it's absolutely true what Kevin said. There was a huge, huge barrier and mistrust between the gay community and the police. I remember this well from, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, when the police used to take it upon themselves to come and raid gay bars. I don't know what they thought they was going to find down there, but they did. And they used to come down the, you know, they used to come in the gay bars all gloved up, you know, because they obviously thought they was going to catch something, because obviously the AIDS, HIV, AIDS thing was like really prominent at the time. And they treated us like shit. Yeah.
And I think we'll get to hear that as this story goes on. But if Kevin survived the attack, have we been able to find out what happened to Kevin after?
Yes, that's a shame, isn't it, Will? Sadly, we found that Kevin McDonough died on the 5th of September 2000 at age 46. He died at London's Mildmay Hospital of bronchopneumonia. His death was registered by an officer of the council. They are unable to state his place of birth upon his death certificate, but then do share his date of birth. They are unable to state his occupation, although they share his address was Parliament Hill in Hampstead, London.
I think the fact that he's at Mildmay Hospital indicates that this is HIV/AIDS related bronchopneumonia.
Yeah.
Because the Mildmay Mission Hospital was known to house the UK's first AIDS hospice. Plus, out of all the hospitals located closer to Hampstead Heath, where he lived, the Royal Free Hospital was literally at the end of his road. Then University College Hospital, and then St Mary's at Paddington that had an AIDS ward, and the Whittington Hospital. But he finds himself in the East End of London at the Mildmay Mission Hospital.
And the sad thing is, he was from a big family.
Yes, I pieced his family tree together in a bid to find out where he was today. And he had five other siblings, four older brothers and one younger sister, all born in Clonmel in Ireland. Whether Tower Hamlets made any attempts to track his family down, or maybe his HIV/AIDS diagnosis, his sexuality, or even both presented a problem for the family, we'll never know.
And we find out he could fight off bronchopneumonia at 46, he already must have been quite poorly at the time.
So it's quite surprising that a man, and there's been a couple of other men that we've covered as well, it's quite surprising that when they're in hospital, and he's 46.
Which is young.
if his immune system is not strong to be then with the drugs from the hospital to be able to fight off bronchopneumonia, I think it's quite telling that his immune system is severely weakened. But I just think it's just really quite sad. And it seems to be that the council have registered his death and have been able to find little about him.
That's what I mean. I just thought, you know, that sadness then, because thought there was obviously nobody there with him.
Mm.
You know, so it seemed like, you know, he kind of like died alone.
I think perhaps the only thing that we could probably take away from this is the fact that, given that the death certificate clearly shows that despite him having family, there was no family around to be able to even just register the death, is the fact that he's in the Mild May Mission Hospital, he's on the AIDS hospice ward. I can only imagine from all the stories I've heard that he would have had the care and attention that he deserved in his passing. Yeah. You know, they would have wrapped their arms around him. I mean, Princess Diana, she was a regular visitor there, and they did some amazing work at the Mild May. I think the only saving grace is he didn't die at home alone.
Yeah, which is really nice, you know.
Mm. So, Kevin McDonough, who we've just heard about, has come forward having survived an attack by Looper. And in their investigation around Jim's murder, the police had spoken to friends and family. And by all accounts, Jim was a gentle and friendly gay man that was easily at ease within his own company. He left Edinburgh, Scotland, to join the RAF and was discharged in his mid-20s due to a breakdown. The day before his murder, Saturday the 15th of March 1986, he began drinking early, and by the evening, he was at the Colhern pub in Earl's Court. A typical Sunday night in a thriving gay pub, Jim got talking to customer Donald York, who gave the following statement to the police.
He started a conversation with me during which he told me he had been drinking all day. When I asked him why, he told me he was in love with his brother. No such brother ever existed.
I think that's possibly like a Scottish thing, isn't it? Like, you know, like with the kids today say, my homie, my brother.
Yeah, bro, and all that. Yeah.
I think that's possibly what Jim meant when he spoke to Donald York.
Possibly, yeah. I told him I was waiting for my lover, and he remarked that it was a shame. I asked him why, and he remarked how he thought I was quite nice. I felt as if he was just looking for a bed for the night.
Oh. And this is a time, Buff, you and I will remember, is when you went to a pub, a gay pub, you spoke to people.
You did?
You didn't have your head in your phone.
Oh, God, no, there was none of that nonsense.
No, you actually struck up a conversation with someone.
You did, yeah.
It was the only way you could meet them, unless you were going to send them a fax from the other side of the pub, you know?
That's true, isn't it? Yeah.
So, yeah, good on Jim. He's striking up conversation with another like-minded gay man at the pub. It just turns out, sadly, that Donald's got a partner.
Yeah.
But Donald York also told police he had seen a, quote, a tall, handsome, Italian-looking man wearing a black leather bomber jacket, standing on his own in the pub toilets and masturbating, end quote. And an hour later, Donald and his partner, Paul Spittle, watched Jim and the man climb into a taxi outside the Colhern.
A taxi from the Colhern?
Yeah, it's really bizarre.
But isn't the Colhern only a few minutes' walk from 32 Warwick Road, where Jimmy's found the next day?
Donald York's witness statement that Jim said he'd been drinking all day, I think it's quite chilling to think perhaps how incapacitated and defenseless Jim was. Because remember, he's this big, gentle giant that Looper had to call a taxi.
Yeah, and it's about a two-minute walk. A taxi would have taken around a minute, if that. Makes me wonder why the cabbie took the fare in the first place.
Yeah, it's weird. It really is weird, because black cabs down here would have knowledge, you know, so they would have known instantly when they're outside the call home, where are you going, mate? We're going to Warwick Road. Maybe they were going to go off some... I don't know. I can't believe that Lupo intended to go off somewhere else with Jim, because I think the fact that Jim's ended up back in the same basement as Kevin McDonough, I think he would, and this is his second attempt at murder now, which obviously is sadly successful, that he would have been planning to go to Warwick Road. He knew it was close by. Killers do have these traits, don't they, where they just do, they go places they're familiar with. The whole taxi situation is odd. However, Jim is discovered around 8 a.m. on the morning of Sunday the 16th of March 1986 by unemployed labourer George Thompson on his routine security check of the building, 32 Warwick Road. Detective Superintendent John Shoemake is assigned the case, and he quickly organised a photographer, doctor, and alerts the pathologist, Dr. Ian West. Tate and Wire state in the book, Dr. Stuart Crane, a local GP with a surgery in the nearby Goldhawk Road, pronounced the formal life extinct at 10:27 precisely. So it's 10:27 in the morning. His brief statement to Shoemaker's rapidly assembling squad was similarly specific. He was lying on the floor, partially clothed in motorcycle-type leathers. The body was smeared with what resembled feces and blood. There was blood over his face and injuries to the left side of his head. I did not move the body to confirm whether or not there were other injuries. There was a metal tube under the body pointing towards the anus.
Pathologist Dr. Ian West carries out the post-mortem under 3 hours later, and his findings are shared with the police as follows.
The entire front of James Burns' torso was smeared with feces and blood, and a distinct hand patterning was visible in the dried excrement. There were 3 bite marks on his chest in the region of his right nipple. Part of his tongue had been bitten off and subsequently recovered from the floor across the dirty and sordid basement room. A ligature had been twisted around his neck and tightened sufficiently to asphyxiate him. There was no evidence that he had struggled at all.
Tate and Roy in the book share their interpretation of the scene. The Burns killing was different. There was an element of organisation to it. The murderer had taken away with him whatever he had used to strangle his victim. Then there was patterned smearing of excrement. A typical homosexual killer would have panicked and left the body, not stayed to daub it with its own faeces. The bite marks around the right nipple, neatly grouped and specifically placed together with a seemingly deliberate severing of the tongue, simply didn't fit the known pattern of the hallmark homosexual murders. There was also the mysterious metal tube to consider.
Oh, what are your thoughts?
God, it's a bit of a mess, isn't it? You know, it's like, I reckon he bit his own tongue off for a start. I don't think he was cut out.
Yes, because there's a similar act that occurs from the same method of killing that we'll get to hear about a little bit later, but it's also a common feature of somebody who's been strangled that apparently
bite their own tongue.
Yeah, it's quite graphic, yeah. That you bite down on your own tongue. And
right, okay.
Possibly as Jim severed his own tongue in this case.
And would I take it that Lupo must have, if his tongue was like found over the other side of the room in the debris, I reckon that Lupo must have took his tongue out of his mouth and just threw it or something.
It could be, but then I kind of wonder as well, I know that they say he didn't struggle, but I've seen so many murder documentaries where, you know, today's techniques, they look under fingernails for hair and skin cells, because the natural body reaction to something that's not normal, you know, is to kick in and fight back.
Fight or flight, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
Unless he was either totally intoxicated and he hadn't got much control over his body, you know, he could have been more or less unconscious with the alcohol consumption, because if it's, you know, shows absolutely no sign of any struggle, you know, there's obviously something.
But they say that, but I just can't believe that there's no sign of a struggle. I think as we get to hear later, because there are a couple of men that survive and they give similar accounts where Lupo, to subdue his victim, lashes out. He punches them. Jim's got a head wound. And I can't help but wonder if this is
from the metal bar.
Exactly. Either a blow from Lupo, which I can't believe because he's 5'11", is skinny and scrawny. I've got pictures of him literally just weeks before his arrest, which is, you know, kind of coincides with the time that he was committing these murders. Jim's a big burly guy. So the metal bar, as you've just mentioned, I think is possibly being used as a weapon to whack James around the head.
Yeah.
As James has fallen, the bar's been released and has fallen with him and has landed under his body, because
just basically fallen on top of it. And I think, as you say, yeah, he kind of must have bashed him off that.
Mm.
He must have fell on it.
Mm. Because I think the police here, the pathologist, saying that this metal bar has been strategically placed to the anus, because, you know, gay men are all into this.
Yeah.
I think I wasn't there. We haven't seen the crime scene photos, but I think just common sense tells you that there's no benefit, you know. They don't say that the anus was ruptured. And in regards to this blood, obviously that's perhaps going to come from the mouth. But this smearing of excrement, I can't help but think that, as I know with family, when somebody passes away, their body naturally just releases their bowels.
Yeah.
And naturally that occurs. And I can't help but, if Lupo's carrying out this act and is trying to be sexually aroused in some way, don't forget he's fumbling around in the dark.
in a basement flat. Even with the full moon out, it's going to be dark and dingy down there. There's, you know, no electricity because it's a building site.
That's correct, yeah.
That he's found he's got feces on his hands. What's he going to do? You're going to wipe it somewhere.
Mm.
And I think, you know, unfortunately, it's Jim's torso that he's wiped his hand in an attempt to clean them. You know, I mean, it's awful, but I think that's it. There's going to be there's clearly nothing for him. There's nothing for Lupo to wipe his hands on, and you're not going to leave the building with excrement on your hands, are you?
No, you're not. No.
I think to suggest that he's smearing it in some kind of sadistic act, I think, again, is misleading.
Yeah, I do as well. Looking into it like deeper, and now you've explained it more, definitely so will you. Yeah.
Because I think one thing that gay men do have is a reputation of cleanliness.
Well, yeah, and
Lupo considers himself to be, as we'll get to here later on, he's mixing with some high profile and high society people. You know, he considers himself to be very dapper and well dressed and exceptionally groomed. I just can't feel, unless that's what he's into, that he's playing with his feces deliberately in a dark.
That's it. I mean, excrement. It's kind of a fetish thing, anyway. So there's been no indication of that happening before.
And it doesn't happen after.
Yeah, yeah. So I reckon it's what, as you just said, yeah. Mm. The tail, you know, just wiping his hands on the body.
Mm, just to try and clean it off as much as possible. As he's fumbling down there, he's accidentally, you know, come into contact with it.
Yeah.
Good.
So we know Lupo was eventually caught, charged and sentenced, but did he have anything to say to investigators after his arrest?
Yes. And one of the lead detectives on the case, Detective Inspector Peter Elcock, told Tate and Wire in their book, he, Lupo, was incredibly calm. He just sat there as we went through the allegations with him. He then said he did the murders. The next day, we interviewed him again and he admitted the Burns murder, biting off his tongue and smearing feces over the body. As if that wasn't enough, he told us he had also tried to pull the man's eyes out. And in his statement to the police, Lupo said, "I was very cold. I was very, very excited a few moments earlier. I wasn't interested in having sex. I just lost all excitement. I started shaking, and the only thing I wanted to do was kill him." Lupo doesn't necessarily play with the police in regards to changing his statement, you know, from this to this.
Yeah.
And I think he is being quite honest, but I just can't help but feel when he says he admits to smearing feces on the body, I think it's probably due to the same circumstances that we spoke about. We don't hear from Tate and Wire or from Elcock, you know, that he got a kick out of this or this is what he enjoyed. He told us that, you know, he had a fetish for this. And similarly,
I think he's kind of saying that, you know what I mean? And where's the evidence about trying to pull his eyes out as well?
Again, we don't have access to post-mortem information to establish whether there's clearly an attempt to pull out his eyes.
I was just going to say, there's nothing in the kind of like evidence here that we've got where there's marks around the victim's eyes or anything. So again, we don't know. We'll never know because, you know, we haven't got the medical records, have we?
You know,
the coroner's report.
But I think what this book does is similar to what the newspapers do, where in regards to a lot of the HIV/AIDS stories that we've covered, is that the newspapers didn't generally tell you any untruths. They didn't lie. They gave you information, but they just didn't elaborate on it. So they were kind of dropping seeds and it was up to you.
It was drip fed. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what the press and be really good at that, isn't they? Drip feeding the public little pieces and snippets of information.
Mm. I mean, like just going back to the book where they say, you know, again, and he admitted the Burns murder, biting off his tongue and smearing feces over the body. But the book doesn't say, or the Inspector Peter Elcock doesn't substantiate that claim by saying, and we know from the post-mortem or from the photographs that this to be true. So they're not saying whether it's true or not. They're not confirming nor denying it. They're just telling us what Lupo said. I don't believe it. I think I'm still sticking by my common sense theory. What about you?
Definitely common sense theory, Will, on this one. Yeah, I mean, you know, you can kind of read between the lines, can't you? You know, and so, yeah, I'm going with my gut instinct on this one.
Jim's death certificate records the cause of death as 1A compression of the neck. And I did find surviving family for Jim and invited them to share more about Jim and the kind of man that he was. And although my message was read, I got no response. And I respect the fact that their loss is no doubt still raw today as it was back in 1986. Lupo had struck again on the evening of Saturday the 5th of April, yet the press didn't report the murder of the young man until Lupo had been caught. One of the first articles I could find was that from the hometown of the young man, where they put the story on the front page of the Newcastle Journal on the 12th of May 1986.
This was the murder of 26-year-old Anthony Connolly, Tony to those who knew him best. The front page headline read, AIDS alert after North Man killer. The article reads, a delayed murder investigation was going on last night after a Tyneside man thought to have been an AIDS carrier was found strangled on a London railway embankment. Tony Connolly, known by police to have been homosexual, was found dead on April the 6th, but because of the AIDS scare, a full post-mortem examination could not be held until May the 2nd. Mr. Connolly, who comes from Benjamin Road, Wallsend, was found in a workman's hut on the Catford Loop railway line, Brixton, London, by children.
Oh, it's no age, is it? 26 That's, years old.
That is so sad, Will.
And Tate and Wire in their book share intelligence that the police gathered on Tony and the kind of young man he was. They wrote,
Anthony Connolly was 26 and flamboyantly homosexual. He had left school in Newcastle-upon-Tyne with an A-level in art. Cheerful, thoughtful and relaxed man, he was not promiscuous by the standards of some sections of the gay community. His friends never detected any overriding interest in sadomasochism. After studying art on a degree course, he drifted into the catering industry. By January 1986, he was employed as a chef at a vegetarian restaurant in the East End in London. When its owner, in keeping with a growing public taste for vegetarian food, decided to transfer the business to Soho, Tony Connolly was temporarily laid off. The lack of a steady wage didn't prevent him from frequenting his regular haunts, the Colhern Pub in Earls Court, the Prince of Wales in Brixton, and Heaven, a gay club situated just north of Hungerford Bridge in Villiers Street, WC2.
And one of the people police spoke to was Tony's friend, Simon Walder.
That's right. Tony had been renting a room at Simon's flat in Brixton. Both gay, they had occasionally slept together, and it was Simon who was the one that told detectives that Tony had absolutely shown no interest in S&M.
But Tate and Wire note in their book that the police felt Tony and his eclectic and quirky fashion sense, along with his youthful good looks, would attract attention. Although they both felt wearing leather was the link between the victims and the murderer, where they wrote, in part, this was due to his adoption of at least some of the leather uniform. He habitually wore a black leather motorbike jacket embellished with an eye-catching display of silver studs. A sartorial message to S&M inclined gays that its wearer might be open to offers. Oh, God. Tony Connolly had lived on the gay scene long enough to know the confusion he was causing. Oh, you're going to have to speak about this in a minute, but I feel this is absolute bullshit, no?
Yeah.
Indeed, there is some evidence that he had accepted the advances of at least one sadistic partner whom he allowed to, quote, fist fuck his anus.
Oh, God.
Back to the black leather glove.
The thing is, I was actually, in the late 80s, I was a goth, right? And right. I was a goth for many years. So I used to wear a black leather jacket emblazoned with studs. Did anybody approach me to be fisted? Never. I think, again, it's been glamorized and all this stuff that's been put in these articles is kind of let's make it more sensational than it already is, because we all know if somebody wears a black leather motorbike jacket on the gay scene, that them into all kinds of debauchery and unsavory practices.
And I also found some footage of men in London around the time of the murders, so, you know, mid to late 80s, that spoke about the leather uniform. So let's take a listen.
Yeah.
Some gay men on the leather scene have developed very direct forms of signalling their sexual preferences.
They're usually more open about what they do between the sheets through a very complicated system of keys and different coloured handkerchiefs. Depending on what the person does or wants to do, they have a combination of one or more of these either on the left-hand side if you're active or on the right-hand side if you're passive.
So why are some gay men now adopting a much more masculine and aggressive image than gay men on the drag scene? Brian Derbyshire agrees that leather is a reaction against the traditional image of gay men.
Well, it was a really, when I was a teenager, the image of gay people was a very camp, you know, outrageous, you know, 14 yards of chiffon, and everyone called each other Beryl and Darling and kissed each other everywhere and wore Woolley's false eyelashes. But I found, basically, I found the scene very embarrassing for the fact that it was a split thing. You were one thing during the week, and then you had to sort of rush off to Manchester or Liverpool, where all the big clubs were, and become something else. You know, dash on the train and slap the pan stick on and the Woolley's false eyelashes, which, you know, and I actually got to thought to myself, well, if this is it, you know, really, I just don't want to know, because I just got fed up of it after a time. But I'm very embarrassed. It's very embarrassing walking through Manchester with a simulated fur coat over your shoulders and Woolley's false eyelashes. So really, you had a choice. If you wanted to get to mix with gay people, you had to become like they were. Otherwise, if I'd have walked down like this in those days, they'd have run a bloody mile. So it was this ultra camp, you know, limp-wristed bit. If there's anything else you wanted, it just wasn't there. It just didn't exist, not at all. And it's only in the last 5 or 6 years, really, that the scene has begun to broaden out, and really only in London. If you go back to the provinces, I mean, I go back to Preston quite a lot, and you see it in Preston. It's a bit like getting a time machine and going back 6 or 7 years.
But even in London, the leather scene is largely confined to the West, areas like Earl's Court and Chelsea. This Earl's Court pub, the Colhern, is its focal point. So why did the leather scene start here? The explanation is that areas like this are much more open to new influences than, say, traditional working-class areas with more conservative attitudes. This is bedsit land with a large floating population and many foreigners passing through. And leather was really a foreign import. It came to England in the mid-60s from America.
I mean, like this is a Canadian cap. The leather jacket, which is the original one, was the copy of what the cops used to wear in Los Angeles. These are, what I got on now, are chaps, or what the cowboys used to wear. So it's all originally American orientated.
Leather isn't the only reaction against the old feminine image of gays, though. There are other ways of looking masculine without going to such an extreme.
Of course, you don't have to be either a drag queen or a leather queen. There are plenty of other ways of being a gay man, still recognisably male. And I suppose that one of the fastest growing new looks is the clone look, which came to us by courtesy of New York and is threatening to take over.
So very clear insight there into the image of the leather man, and that was taken from a documentary made in 1981 titled Heaven, Gay Life. And it just seems to be men that wear leather or are attracted to leather are generally just taking a step back from the camp gay image.
If you look back to the pop culture of the 80s, in the UK, we had a really famous group called Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And you look at the two, well, Ollie Johnson is the lead singer, and there was another guy called Paul Rutherford. And Paul Rutherford was the typical butch male leather clad.
Right.
Yeah. And Ollie Johnson was the typical feminine kind of asexual guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
he wore like a lot of t-shirts and blazers and jackets and stuff.
Hot. That's right. Yeah. And right. Paul Rutherford wore white t-shirts, black leather jeans, a black leather cap, you know, very stereotypical gay man look of the time.
So it's not really indicating that he's into S&M or even extreme S&M.
Not at all, you know. No, not
just an image.
Just an image, you know.
Yeah.
You know, you still get leather bars and that now.
Yeah, yeah.
And also it was there was a parody of it in one of the Police Academy movies.
Right.
As well, which was it called? The Blue Oyster Bar. Yeah. So I think it was the 80s gay scene, basically, that it was of the time.
Fashion and a trend, and it still exists in small pockets today. I know I worked in a bar in Soho that was full of leather men and Tom of Finland images.
There you go. Yeah, Tom of Finland, ultimate classic, you know.
I suppose when the police are looking at this, they're kind of letting their imaginations run quite wild, because they're looking at it from a... I mean, these policemen, I don't think they were incredibly old. They weren't crusty investigators, but I think they were in their 30s, 40s, but they're looking at it through, you know, heterosexual eyes.
They're looking at it through heterosexual eyes, and they're also looking at it through gay men are completely obsessed with sex.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not a normal act. It's immoral.
It's not a normal act, so it's got to be the most degrading, you know, practice ever. So of course they've got to like put these labels on these people. And as we know, we've discussed, didn't we? You know, the relationship between us and them.
Mm.
You know, the gay community and you know the Met. It was awful. It was a two way thing, really. Will, you know, you can't totally blame the police because we were the ones that were kind of like holding back as well,
and
I'm grateful now that obviously in forward in time that we have got like kind of a better relationship now with the police.
Mm. So do we know Tony's movements that led up to his murder?
Well, Tate and Moya, having had access to the police files, wrote in their book at 2100 on Saturday the 5th of April 1986, he, Tony, left Simon Mulder's flat on Cowley Estate in southwest London and headed for the Prince of Wales in Cold Harbour Lane, Brixton. He was wearing the black leather jacket over a green T-shirt with a Newcastle Royal Victoria Infirmary emblem upon it and a handkerchief knotted around his neck. But it was the clothes from the waist down that attracted most attention. Under remarkably distressed and severely slashed blue jeans, Tony Connolly sported a pair of shocking pink tights. Fabulous.
Yeah.
Michele Lupo arrived at the pub at 21:30 the same evening in the company of a platonic girlfriend and quickly struck up a conversation with a handful of her acquaintances they had bumped into. No one saw him slip out of the Prince of Wales, but Tony Connolly left just before 1 a.m. His last conversation was with the doorman and concerned the pink tights, which had attracted more than their fair share of interest throughout the evening.
There are no witnesses to describe the meeting between Michele Lupo and Tony Connolly, but it is clear that very shortly after leaving the pub, both men agreed on a spot of quick trade, a euphemism for impromptu and frequently al fresco sex. The main railway line through South London runs for a time alongside Ferndale Road, Brixton. Disused line workers' huts punctuate the otherwise drab landscape of inner city dereliction. It was one of these that Michele Lupo led his victim. Once inside, both men removed various layers of clothing and began to caress.
It was later stated that within minutes, Tony Connolly found something tightening around his neck and he died without struggling.
So when this later stated, it must have come from Lupo.
Yeah. Yeah, it must have done, yeah, because obviously Tony was already dead.
Exactly.
Yeah. Michele Lupo sauntered out of the hut and clambered back across the rail lines to Ferndale Road. He hailed a black cab and asked the driver to take him to a nightclub. For the next hour, he danced, drank and socialised with no evident concern for the body in the railway hut. At 3 a.m, he went home and slept.
What an arsehole.
I know.
Ugh.
He completely disassociated himself from killing someone.
It's mad, isn't it? It's crazy.
Well, that's the mind. Obviously, that's the mind of a psychopath. You know, and you know, a regular kind of like normal, I suppose, a normal functioning mind person.
Mm.
You know, if you've hurt somebody with your words, sometimes you carry a little bit of guilt around with you. And let alone, like, cold-blooded to killing somebody and then just going around on again with your day. You know what I mean? Well, especially dancing in a nightclub. Just typical kind of psychopathic behaviour.
Madness.
Two schoolboys found Tony Connolly at 5 p.m. that Sunday. Adrian Power and Shane Hughes were playing on the lines when they peered in through the hut's dirty window. Even through layers of grit and grime, the teenagers could see the body on the floor was uncomfortably still. They also noticed that its trousers were round its ankles. There was a bruise on one eye and the bite marks on the torso. They ran until they found a policeman. The subsequent post-mortem established that Tony Connolly had died from asphyxiation and that there was evidence of other abuse on his body. The bite marks in particular were curiously placed on the chest, neck and penis. Additionally, a small bottle marked TNT was found beside his body.
See, I think going back to what we discussed about Jim earlier in possibly was there a struggle, was there not a struggle, and the head injury that Jim had sustained is that Tony Connolly here has been described as having a black eye. He's not going to have given that to himself, is he?
No, of course not, no.
So that, again, I think he's probably the same with Jim, in this big burly guy who's, you know, he's had a few bevies, a few drinks, is that Lupo was to incapacitate these men as has delivered a blow of some sort.
Yeah, he must have done. And I think as well, maybe the bite marks were done after the death.
But again, these bite marks, and a lot of people, as I said at the outset of this episode, is that, you know, people glamorize it saying, oh, he's a biter. You know, he likes to bite. I can't help but think, is this just not a case of trying to get sexually aroused?
I should say so, especially with the bite marks. And obviously as well, what's convinced me that was done after death is because there's no sign of struggle with the victim. If somebody's biting your chest or wherever they're biting you, you know what I mean? So it's really sinking their teeth in, you would actually put up a fight unless it was held down where there'd be bruises across the arms or the legs or whatever. And that doesn't indicate there was any again, does that?
But I wonder though, how hard are these bite marks? Because is it just a case of just a passion, two guys that are really kind of trying
to... Yeah, I was just going to ask you this time. I was
get
just
aroused. Because I think we've all done it. We've all nibbled down a little bit too hard. And the
that's
other,
it, yeah.
I the mean, other person's gone, in, oh, God.
Yeah, that's it. Like, as in, like, a, you know, kind of a eat of the moment bite mark a vicious bite mark.
Yeah, like a deliberate... Because I know there are some serial killers that have sunk their teeth into people and they've been able to get impressions and find out. Because I think we'll come on to learn that Lupo was trying to elevate his sexual experiences, which sadly led to murder. That if he's just, before he perhaps undertakes the killing, he's trying to get the arousal that he's seeking. And when he doesn't get it,
he
unfortunately ends their lives.
That's it, Will. And you know, when it says like a bruise on the one eye, could, you know, if you hit somebody hard enough, could that have knocked Tony unconscious?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. He's only a you know, a slight guy. I mean, Lupo was as well, but
yeah,
you know, 26-year-old. And this, again, he's been drinking that night. You know, he's been out drinking and having
a
good
time. There you go, yeah.
And the simplest way to knock him unconscious, which I think is a horrible thing to do, and it's quite callous. But I think for a murderer to knock your victim out before you perhaps end their life is quite telling in Lupo that he's quite, what's the word I'm looking for? He's not the big macho man.
No, he has to have a helpless victim.
Yeah,
that's what it is. It's like a control dominance thing.
Yeah.
And then he can, like, you know, I've just read that again, you know, curiously placed on the chest, neck and penis. You know, the bottle of TNT, by the way, is poppers.
But what do they mean, curiously placed? Is it, again, like Jim, just around the nipple area, which we know to be an erogenous zone?
Yeah, chest, neck and penis. They're all three erogenous zones.
So it would suggest that you're trying to get some kind of heightened sexual experience.
Yeah, unless he was trying to bite his penis off.
Well, a lot of people claimed that the penis was bitten off and that he was trying to bite it off. But again, I just don't see it. I think perhaps it was all a bit frenzied and, you know, he's trying to really kind of get this, you know, heightened sexual experience. He's perhaps just sadly bitten down a little bit too hard. It's left a mark.
And I wonder as well if this Lupo, when he was committing these, you know, like the bites and the murders, I wonder if he was masturbating as he was doing it or after he did it. Because nothing's ever said about that either, is it? Whether it was a sexual gratification kind of murder.
The killings. Yeah. I think we'll get to learn more in the Lupo episode, but I do get the feeling that, I don't know, I get the feeling that he was perhaps seeking sexual gratification, and when it just wasn't being fulfilled in these locations, he decided to end their lives. I mean, he said with Jim, didn't he, that he when once they got to the basement flat, he wasn't feeling excited anymore and he just had this urge just to kill him.
It's probably the fear took over the excitement.
And if the taking of Tony's life wasn't enough, the family had to contend with newspaper reports in their local paper. As we heard earlier, the Newcastle Journal on the 12th of May 1986 ran the headline, AIDS alert after North man killed. And the following day in the same paper, they run the headline, AIDS fear delayed murder autopsy, with the strapline, blood test row held up post-mortem on homosexual.
That's right. And the article reads, the HSS regulations on the handling of post-mortem examinations on suspected AIDS victims delayed the autopsy of murder Tyneside Tony Connolly. A spokesman for Southwark Borough Council in London said, the body was delivered to the Southwark mortuary on April the 7th because it's the nearest morgue to the spot where Connolly was found. The superintendent found out that the body was that of a homosexual who had a relationship with an AIDS carrier. He invoked the agreed procedure laid down in the DHSS guidelines. This means a blood sample must be taken to establish if the body is infected. However, the police pathologist refused to do this, saying it was not necessary. The morgue staff, who are members of the National Union of Public Employees, refused to help with the post-mortem with the backing of their management. The spokesman said that on April the 25th, the police pathologist changed his mind and agreed to the blood test. This was carried out on April the 28th and proved there was no AIDS risk on April the 29th. As a result, the post-mortem was eventually held at Southwark Mortuary on May the 2nd. Tony's mother, no doubt distraught at the news her son had been murdered, is quoted as saying, "The longer it goes on, the more distressing it is. We are just waiting to hear further details. All we were told was that he had been murdered by a person or persons unknown. We don't know what happened and I don't really want to know."
Oh, his poor mother. But I think it's quite interesting as well that the police not really pushing for an AIDS test.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of interesting, really. I think they were just concerned about the where and how he was murdered.
Yeah, rather than whether he had AIDS or not, which is quite interesting. Yeah. So where did all this chatter that Tony was and or had been in contact with a, quote, AIDS carrier come from?
Well, the AIDS element only came from an innocent conversation Tony's friend and flatmate, Simon Walder, of which the Daily Telegraph reported on the 11th of July, 1987, when they wrote, "Mr. Walder is an AIDS carrier, and when he arrived at the Southwark mortuary to identify Mr. Connolly's body, he mentioned this to the pathologist. As a result, the mortuary staff, fearing that Mr. Connolly had also contracted AIDS and that they might be infected, refused to allow the post-mortem examination on Mr. Connolly to proceed. It was 4 weeks before the examination was finally carried out. At this time, the police had not firmly linked the deaths of Burns and Connolly." And do we know what happened to Simon Walder?
Well, in researching Simon Walder, I quickly learned he had sadly passed away on the 3rd of May 1995, aged only 41, at St. Thomas Hospital, London. His death certificate indicates he died of several age-related complications. He was a secretary for a very influential shipping family who registered the death the following day and had him cremated on the 9th of May 1995 and his ashes interred on the 12th of May 1995 at Kensal Green Cemetery. Simon also made panel 17 of the AIDS quilt for one of his friends, Chris, along with submitting a letter relating to another panel that wished to keep the deceased anonymous, with Simon stating in his letter, "They remained anonymous for a very good reason," and he and the deceased were close friends for 10 years. In 1991, before his death, Simon donated a Paul Smith World AIDS Day t-shirt made the previous year to the Victoria and Albert Museum, and it remains there in their archive. There were a few other insights that I found, but have not yet been able to verify.
As we learned, Tony tested negative for HIV, so was not with an HIV/AIDS diagnosis. Tony's death was subject to an inquest which ruled his cause of death as 1A, asphyxia, and B, strangulation by a ligature.
And Tony's family got to eventually lay Tony to rest?
Yes, they did. And on the 29th of May 1986, Tony's mother, Rose, told the Newcastle Journal more about her much-loved son, who she'd last seen at Christmas in 1985. The article shares, "He was a very happy, good-natured person and well-loved member of our family," said Mrs. Connolly. "I knew he was gay. We all did. There was no secret about that. We all just accepted Tony for what he was. He was very likeable and made good friends wherever he went." Mrs. Connolly said that after training at St. Martin's Art College, London, her son had returned to the North East and done some art teaching at North Tyneside College. But cutbacks at the college saw him leave for London again, where he wasn't able to find a teaching job and took up casual work. Mrs. Connolly said Tony had got to know some pop people while in London. "He mentioned some pop singers' names, but nobody I would be prepared to name. He liked pop music and probably got to meet them from his college days, socialising generally. He was also very keen on opera. He had been training to be an opera singer, but found the lessons in London too expensive."
Oh, isn't it like it's sad to think that a sequence of events, you know, perhaps if there hadn't been the cutbacks in the college in Tyneside, he perhaps would have stayed there and trained. But then I suppose coming to London would have been so exciting for a young gay man that was walking around.
Yeah, following his dream.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his personality with the shocking pink tights that they discussed in the book, you know,
he must have been like a really kind of lovely, flamboyant character.
Yeah, quirky and just, you know, into his art and stuff.
Yeah.
He expressed through his fashion, and sadly he just encountered Lupo. It's just, oh, it's awful.
It is awful, Will.
And I did locate and reach out to Tony's brother and one of his sisters, who, incidentally, is an opera singer, but sadly, I haven't heard back.
On the first anniversary of Tony's death, the family placed a notice of remembrance in the Newcastle Journal. Your beautiful spirit lives on, but we will grieve for you forever. Thank you for 26 wonderful years, remembered by your heartbroken mother, sister and brother.
Oh, it's just sad, 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 sad. And 12 days after taking the life of Tony, Lupo takes the life of another man, although the police are not connecting this murder with the others and the press are again slow to report the murder of this man.
Yes, local press in London reports a series of articles that appeal for information, such as the Westminster and Pimlico News, which reported on the 15th of May 1986 under the headline, Police Hunt for Murderer. Police are still trying to identify a man found murdered on the footpath of Hungerford Bridge in the early hours of April the 18th. He is described as a vagrant type, white, aged about 60 years, wearing a dark overcoat and tartan scarf. The man was discovered about 2 a.m. on Friday, April the 18th, and a post-mortem found he had been strangled. Posters and handbills have been distributed in an attempt to identify and to help find his murderer. If anyone has any information which may help in the search, they're asked to contact the incident room at Bow Police Station. All information will be treated as strictly confidential.
I mean, the fact that we're talking about the murder of this man perhaps is alluding that, you know, Lupo is connected. But do we know what intelligence the police had gathered? Although it seems like, from this article, not a lot.
Well, the only insight we get is from the book by Tate and Moyer, who had unlimited access to the case files. And all they can tell us is how the man was found. Given there is so much misreporting about all the men, even today on blogs and podcasts, it is this man and the manner in which he was murdered and then found that is often always exaggerated or told in a way that isn't even close to the fact.
And just to butt in here, actually, some of the podcasts, even in just in recent years, they were talking that this man was severely, obviously he was murdered, he was killed. So, you know, that's bad in itself, but they, you know, that he was beaten up and that there was so many horrible and awful acts that were carried out and that his body was thrown into the Thames. But it's just all glamorized and sensationalized, because you're going to go on to tell us, I suspect, that this wasn't the case. His life
was ended. Because Tyne and Moyer wrote, at 1 a.m. on Friday, 18th of April, 1986, Stephen McKean climbed the steps between Embankment Station and the Hungerford Bridge. At the top, he began walking towards the centre of the bridge. Stephen McKean was 17 years old, unemployed and very drunk. He had spent the evening sinking into an alcoholic depression at his unpromising circumstances, and by midnight had decided to commit suicide. The Hungerford Bridge was to be his passage into the next, with better luck, world. To get to the bridge, he had crossed Villa Street and along by the area of Charing Cross Station, known as the Arches. Here, vagrants, the homeless and those down on their luck sleep out in cardboard boxes. Cardboard City was by 1986 a thriving community of enforced squalor. As Stephen McKean walked to the centre of Hungerford Bridge, he noticed what he thought to be a resident of the Arches lying sprawled in the middle of the footbridge. Immersed in his own thoughts of self-destruction, he managed to ignore the vagrant for some 5 minutes. But when faced with the prospect of a long and doubtless painful drop, he managed to regain his will to live and suddenly noticed that the tramp was distinctly still. To his credit, he tried hard to revive him before realising that such effort was hopeless. He quickly summoned help. Stephen McKean might have been forgiven for feeling aggrieved at what happened to him next.
Ooh.
He was detained for no less than 36 hours and questioned repeatedly. It was clear from the detective's approach that they were very unhappy about his presence on the bridge, so close to a dead body. But in part, Mr. McKean had himself to blame. Not merely was his suicide story viewed with some suspicion, but he also insisted on giving his interrogators a bogus name. There was nothing in those crucial early hours to link the killing of the unnamed vagrant with a nascent series of murderous attacks on the young homosexuals and the AMIP's area. Only the cause of death was the same, strangulation by a scarf. Had the police had the benefit of the FBI's in-depth profiling, its killers being organised, they might have attached some extra significance to the only other remarkable evidence found at the scene. Someone, presumably the murderer, had gone to some trouble to move the body. There were drag marks 2 feet wide and stretching for some 15 yards. It pointed to an organised killer.
This is where Tate and Wire discuss in the book about criminal profiling. They say that this killing was organised, because I think as we come on to learn a little bit later and in the Lupo episode, that this was really just an unorganised killing. It was a spare of the moment killing.
Like a random killing.
Yeah, it was completely, because this vagrant, this man isn't believed to be a homosexual. He's in his 60s. Again, he's a vagrant type. So, you know, Lupo does go on to confess that he wasn't looking for sex. I think you're probably going to tell us how he ended the life of this man, sadly.
Well, the mile unknown was never identified. His death was recorded as mile unknown 860. The police foils go on to share that almost to the minute, 24 hours later, Lupo not only struck again in the early hours of the 19th of April 1996, but he did with the very same area of Villa's Lane by Heaven nightclub in Charing Cross.
Oh, this is the utter gall of this man to return. And I think we discussed this prior, where we both know from, again, from documentaries we watched, that sometimes killers do get a kick out of returning to the scene of the crime, especially when there's police on scene. They somehow find this thrilling to be so close to the scene of the crime again. But here he is, 24 hours later, as we're going to learn, and he strikes again. And this was another attack that didn't make the newspapers until after Lupo was arrested and the evidence was presented at his trial at the Old Bailey in July 1987. The fifth person to encounter Lupo was, sadly, 22-year-old Mark Leyland. Born in 1964 and originally from Liverpool, Mark was a chef at a Park Lane hotel at the time he encountered Lupo. Like Kevin McDonough, who we discussed earlier, Lupo's attack on Mark failed, and Mark was able to eventually provide the police with a statement. Tate and Wire give us an insight from the police case files and the police interview with Mark, where the book states, he finished work at 23:30 that Friday and, after a brief drink with some friends, set off in the direction of Heaven. He had no intention of going inside the club. Instead, he had hoped to pick up a man on the street surrounding it. One of those was Villa Street near Hungerford Bridge.
Yeah, that's killed. Where the vagrant was killed, wasn't he?
And it's less than 24 hours later and he's back prowling, cruising for another man. Now, Mark didn't speak to the press, understandably, as we discussed earlier, with the distrust between the gay community and the press and the gay community and the police. As I said a moment ago, the attack on him didn't really come to light until press reports on the trial of Lupo in July 1987. But Tate and Wyatt do share Mark's police statement to the police as follows. I had read that it was the place to go if you wanted to meet someone. I arrived at Villa Street and sat down on a seat by the entrance of the underground. Then I got up and started walking, still looking for someone. So he's cruising, isn't he?
Yeah.
I walked down on the footway on the left-hand side and saw a man walking up the footway on the right. I can't remember who made the approach or what was said, but I do know that we came up to each other and spoke. I told the man my name was Marco. I didn't tell him my real name because I didn't want him to know who I really was. He suggested we go to a place that he knew nearby, and I agreed and walked with him. Although we didn't discuss what we were agreeing to, we were both aware of what was going to happen. Tate and Wire, having access to the case files, wrote, Mark Leyland followed Michelle Lupo down a dark and twisting alley and eventually through the broken glass of a derelict and dirty disused toilet. Both men pulled down their trousers and Lupo pushed forward his penis for the younger man to fellate. Mark Leyland was never quite sure what made him change his mind, but something prompted him to stop giving Lupo oral sex. Oh. In his statement to police, Mark continued, I remember saying, I can't do it, and moving away from him in this small room. He began to hit me hard on the top of my head with his fists a number of times. That's quite interesting. I don't remember it hurting at that point in time, but I didn't defend myself. I said, don't hurt me. He didn't say anything. He got out of the window and I was left inside. He came back very soon after and started to hit me through the window with what I thought was a plank of wood. I remember that whatever he had must have been pretty large because he was standing back from the window to push the object through and was sort of prodding me with it very heavily about my head and face. I turned away from him and the object. He continued to hit the back of my head. I don't think I called out or said anything, and he wasn't saying anything. I think I must have lost consciousness. Oh. See, he says it's a dark room. The police are saying it's a toilet. And I can't help but wonder if the whole derelict toilet thing is the police feeding into, or the Tate and Wire feeding into the whole gays carry out this behaviour in toilets.
Yeah.
I mean, could well have been, you know, there might be scene of crime photographs that they've looked at or details from police statements that were made. But Mark just refers to it as a room.
I mean, it's interesting that he had that kind of... that Mark had that kind of hunch as well to stop giving Lupo or performing oral sex on Lupo, which is a good job he did.
Mm.
you know, because that may have been, he may have been murdered if it had carried on.
Because I think we'll come to learn, even with a couple of other people that survived, that there is a pattern emerging where
they're
in that act. Next that follows is the end of their life.
So Tatum Moyer went on to share, eventually Mark Leyland crawled out and through the toilet's broken window and collapsed on the pavement in Hungerford Lane. At 4:15 a.m, he was found by a local beat policeman. It is hard to resist the belief that whatever his uncertainty over the homosexual urges which had begun to dominate his life, Mark Leyland knew that the brand of sex he sought that night would be on the rough side.
Complete bollocks, isn't it?
That's just nonsense.
When you go cruising, I mean, you know, you've done it, I've done it. You don't go looking for a brand of rough sex when you go cruising, especially when you're in a built-up area, whether it's derelict or not. I mean, even up on Hansard Heath, when guys are cruising, they're not looking for a rough brand of sex.
Well, no, surely that's kind of a niche thing that you wouldn't possibly expect when you're going cruising.
No, because you haven't, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it always a case of, you know, you might start with a bit of oral sex and then might lead on to a bit of penetrative sex. You might shout out or demand a couple of slaps here and there if that's your thing, but you're not looking for S&M or a rough brand of sex that Tate and Wire talk about here.
No, but again, as we've discussed before, it's obviously the whole kind of, you know, the debauchery that goes with the whole gay stroke homosexual label back then in the day.
And I think while they are both at the time, and I think they still are, respected journalists and documentary makers, I think we have to bear in mind they had a book to sell here.
Well, yeah, they've got a sensationalised thing. You know, they've got to put a bit of grit in it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I understand. But, like, looking back now in hindsight, it's kind of a bit silly, isn't it, reading all this quotes from the book.
Yeah, especially when they're saying that Mark was only acting on homosexual urges. So they're not saying that he's a gay man. He's perhaps just wanting, at a young age, 20, 21, 22, just wants to experiment. So I don't think he's walking into an extremely built-up area by Heaven nightclub in a derelict building that he's looking for a rough brand of sex. Is perhaps
no. We can overlook that part. Will
literally he has, like he said in his statement, he started to perform oral sex, and whether he just got a gut feeling that something wasn't right, or that he just oral sex on a man just wasn't for him, or Looper wasn't right, he stopped.
Just as well he did stop.
And it's this kind of language and attitude by Tate and Wire that saw Mark report the attack of 1986 as a, quote, vicious mugging, instead of sharing that he had gay urges and sought to have a sexual encounter with a gay man, given the mistrust with the police at the time, which is incredibly sad.
And in your capacity of North London's modern day Jessica Fletcher, Will, did you find Mark Leyland?
I did. He read my message, but I didn't hear anything back. And I can't imagine, so I didn't push it, but I can't imagine how you live your life knowing that several men sadly lost theirs and you could have been one of them.
It must have been completely life-changing for Mark in every way, you know. So sad, really, that he never kind of contacted you. But 6 days after his attack on Mark Leyland, Lupo approached 22-year-old Damien. Damien Michael McCloskey was born in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, on the 7th of September 1963 and was the youngest of seven children. Sometime in October 1985, Damien, aged then 22, heads to London, where he landed a job at the Phil Beach Hotel in Earls Court. The Phil Beach Hotel was well known and fondly remembered as the first and biggest gay hotel in Europe. Run by a gay couple and attracting a mainly gay clientele, and having last seen a refurbishment in the mid-60s, by the 80s and 90s, it was said to be a bit rough around the edges, but still attracted a loyal and faithful gay and transvestite crowd.
And I read on a few Facebook pages people reminiscing of the old times at the Phil Beach, and it sounds absolutely fucking fabulous, which closed sadly in 2008. So many said they spent the night at the Phil Beach, but get this, were never a paying customer. I mean, that tells us all we need to know. And it was known to be a very, very cruisy, which seemed to be its appeal.
Police inquiries quickly established that 22-year-old Damien was well-liked and nobody had a bad word to say about him. And like many of his peers, Damien enjoyed his spare time exploring the bars of Earls Court, given it was the scene's hotspot in the 80s. Those that knew Damien said he was never short of male attention and would occasionally take men back to the safety of his room at the Phil Beach.
Oh, so he's come from Northern Ireland and he's in London, he's 22 and he's having a good time. And
having the time of his life.
Exactly. Like many other gay men, whether they're in the 20s, 30s and 40s, it was just, yeah. he's enjoying himself. I love it.
Exactly. Well, on the 24th of April 1996, Damien comes out of Earl's Court's Copacabana at around 2 a.m. with the intention of heading back to his bed at the Phil Beach Hotel. A 7-minute walk, he heads south down Earl's Court Road and usually turning right onto Tree Bover Road that would take him past 32 Warwick Road, the basement where Kevin McDonough was attacked and where Jim sadly lost his life. On that walk, Damien encounters Lupo walking up Earl's Court Road. Ooh. After exchanging glances, the pair chat. Lupo suggests they find a place and Damien retraces his steps north up Earl's Court Road before turning right onto Cromwell Road.
Oh, don't do it, Damien.
Oh, no. Lupo stops outside 150 Cromwell Road, a building covered in scaffolding. Like 32 Warwick Road, work had commenced at 150 Cromwell Road to convert the property back from a retail and office space to 10 bedsits before working ceased owing to planning application issues. Lupo pointed to the basement and the pair walked across a steel girder before jumping down into the basement of the property from the upper ground floor window. Both lowered their trousers and began to caress, and while Damien began to fillet Lupo, he pulled a curtain off a nearby office trolley and strangled Damien with it until he falls unconscious.
Oh.
Lupo states to the police that he pulled up his own trousers, climbed out of the basement, nailed down a cab and went home and got straight into bed. It took 3 days before friends and colleagues reported Damien missing to the police and a further 3 weeks before Damien's body was found on the 16th of May 1996 after Lupo informed police the location of Damien's body upon his arrest.
Oh, so another young life.
It's just really sad, and the sad part about it is not just the murder part. It was just the 3 weeks before they found his body, you know.
He laid there for 3 weeks in the basement of a derelict building.
Yeah, it's really sad, well, it really is.
Mm.
Previous to Damien's murder, he arrives in London in October 1985, and 6 months later, his life has come to an end. Do we know what drew him to London from Northern Ireland, Will?
Well, I can't be certain, but between April 1984 and December 1984, in the Londonderry Journal, unemployed Damien seems to be hanging around with a lad called James King, who is of a similar age and lives a few doors down from Damien. King steals an imitation gun and conspires to hold up the liquor mart, except the plot is foiled and the pair are before the Belfast magistrate's court. And I should probably actually say that I'm perhaps glamorising this slightly because it wasn't really a plot. I think from what I read, the two were sat on a wall and they were perhaps laughing and joking as young lads do, you know, shall we go? Yeah. And this imitation gun wasn't even a gun that fired any kind of, I think it was a toy, plastic toy gun. It wasn't anything major. And I think they were just perhaps led by King, just having this casual chatter. It was overheard and that's how they became to be in trouble. Now, there isn't a week or month that goes by where King isn't in the Irish newspapers for a range of petty crimes that result in a conviction. Now, I can't give you his full criminal record, but here's a little snippet in such a short space of time. On the 7th of December 1984, Damien and James are in court for the imitation gun. James has the additional charge of stealing the imitation firearm in February 1984. The newspapers don't report on the outcome of the court proceedings, so I assume there wasn't a custodial sentence, as 2 days later, on the 9th of December, James King is back in court for using a, quote, heap of scrap as an illegal taxi on the 24th of March of the same year. And in these proceedings, he is fined £120 and disqualified from driving for 6 months. Then, 9 days later, on the 18th of December, James King is back in court for the same offence from 13th of July of the same year and is fined £50. And similar convictions roll on one after the other, ranging from robbery, handling stolen goods, and by March 1986, murder. Given Damien gets into trouble, and I must stress it was a one-off for Damien, James King seems to have implicated others in prior and subsequent charges. He's a bad influence, and I'm guessing King is perhaps every parent's worst nightmare when discovering their son is perhaps in any way associated with King. Reading all the articles, you quickly get the impression, not that Damien fell in with the wrong person, but more, Damien was with the wrong person at the wrong time. Now, as for Damien, I can't help but suspect, as common sense dictates it, that Damien and or Damien's parents and family said, there's nothing going for you around here. Get yourself off and do something with your life. And Damien, attracted by what London could offer in terms of work and perhaps living out his life true to himself, ends up in London. And as you touched on earlier, those that spoke to the police said Damien was like every other 22-year-old. He was enjoying everything London had to offer.
4 days after Damien's body was found, Damien's sister, on behalf of the McCloskey family, speaks to the Londonderry Journal on the 20th of May 1996. The front page headline reads, "Father dies, son murdered, tragedy for Derry family." The article states, "The police at New Scotland Yard said last night that the body of 22-year-old Damien McCloskey, formerly of Bloomfield Park, Derry, had been found in a derelict house in Cromwell Road, Kensington, London, at the weekend. It is thought Mr. McCloskey had been strangled. The McCloskey family in Derry was shattered at the news of Damien's death on Saturday, coming as it did only 2 days after the sudden death in Derry of Damien's father, Danny McCloskey." Damien's sister Anne, who spoke to the Journal yesterday, said her family were numbed by Damien's death and her mother Ellen was too upset to speak about the incident. She said Damien had been working in a hotel as a domestic assistant for the past 5 months and seemed to have settled well in London and made a lot of friends. He'd gone to London with a friend about 5 months ago, but his friend didn't stick it out. The family had heard nothing from Damien since April the 7th last, but because he had found work and digs and had settled down well with plenty of friends, they didn't think anything could have been wrong. He shared a flat in Kensington with another young man, and it was his flatmate who broke the news by telephone to the McCloskey family on Saturday morning during their father's wake. The family gathered that Damien had last been seen at a nightclub in London, and as far as they were aware, he was murdered about a month ago. The police in London have been in touch with them, and it is understood that Damien's body was formally identified by his flatmate. They do not know when his body will be returned home for burial. They have also been told that a man is being questioned in connection with the murder. Tate and Wire, having had access to the police case files, including Lupo's statements, wrote, "His victim didn't struggle, but died with his tongue clamped down between his teeth in the classic symptoms of strangulation. Lupo adjusted his own trousers, looked around and climbed out of the basement. He hailed a black taxi and went home to sleep. By the time Damien McCluskey's bruised and decomposing body was found 3 weeks later, Lupo would have attacked his last known victims and a noose of evidence would be tightening around his own neck. Damien's death certificate lists his occupation as receptionist and the address he shared a flat on Kennington Road, southeast London, and not Kensington as reported in the press. An inquest was held on the 25th of June 1986 and his cause of death was ruled as compression of the neck."
So again, when they say that there was no struggle, why would Damien's body be bruised?
Well, I think we touched on this earlier, didn't we, when I said because your natural instinct would obviously be to kind of lash out, wouldn't it?
But it must indicate that Lupo is, again, using force to knock his victims, these men, unconscious.
It's really, really sad, really, isn't it?
So I just can't help but think that to do that, there must be some resistance or some struggle. But I guess they're looking for traces on the ground, like when they spoke about the man on Hungerford Bridge. You know, they could see the drag marks. I'd guess if there's a struggle, there'd be signs in regards to the chaos. But again, these are derelict buildings. So how can you decipher just mess in what is essentially a building site and what constitutes a struggle?
Yeah, there is that as well to think about in there.
And did Damien get to return home to his family?
Yes, he did, and I suspect not long after Damien had been found, given in the Derry Journal on the 3rd of June 1986, was the following family notice. McCloskey, 16th of May 1986, in London. Damien, dearly loved son of Ellen and the late Daniel Patrick, Danny McCloskey, and dear brother of Anne, Daniel, Vincent, Molly, Helena and Paul, rest in peace. His remains will be removed from his late residence on Thursday the 5th, instant at 9:30 a.m. for Requiem Mass in St. Joseph's Church at 10 a.m. Funeral immediately afterwards to the city cemetery, Sacred Heart of Jesus, have mercy on his soul.
Oh, and I did make attempts to reach out to the McCloskey family and I did manage to speak to Damien's niece. She shared a little bit of insight, but I didn't hear anything back. And again, this must be so raw for the family even still today.
Oh, yeah, it's just traumatic, totally traumatic.
I mean, it's hard, really. It's that fine line between, as I said at the outset of this episode, wanting to correct all the misinformation in the various blogs and podcasts that I read, which really kind of all centered around Lupa. I felt it was kind of unjust in that, you know, it seemed that, not that we're the best people to do it, but we should try and correct some of that by speaking about the victims as much as we're going to speak about Lupo in the next episode. But I think it is that the family must be very protective when people come along and perhaps want to talk about a family tragedy such as this, you know? I mean,
well, definitely, because as hard as it and difficult as it is, where does the closure ever come into it? The press have got the story, you know, we're talking about it on the podcast, and it's been like pulled apart over the years as well. So there's never really any closure, is there?
No, no. The final man to encounter Lupo was 30-year-old British Railway train guard David Cull. However, like Mark Leyland, Lupo's attack on Cull failed, and David was eventually able to give a statement to the police. It was 2 weeks to the day when Lupo murdered Damien McCloskey that he now meets David Cole on the 8th of May 1986. David leaves the Wandsworth flat he shares with his ex-partner for a bite to eat and cigarettes around midnight. He grabs a burger on Clapham High Street and goes for a stroll down Wandsworth Road. As he reaches the Market Tavern, a gay bar in Vauxhall, he sees two men emerge and slip down the side of the pub for a spot of sex. One of the men quickly returns and David steps forward to show his interest. In his statement to the police, David stated, "As I approached the alleyway, the first man came back out and walked towards me. As we approached one another, we looked at each other. As I passed him, I stopped and looked back, and I saw he had done the same."
And is this man Lupo?
Yeah. Ooh, David, no.
No.
And David, in his statement to police, goes on to state, "We both walked along under the railway bridge and it was obvious there was a sexual attraction between us. I asked him if he wanted to come to my flat and he declined, saying he hadn't got time. We turned left into Wyville Road and he suggested that we should find somewhere to have sex. We crossed over towards the lorry park behind Vauxhall Station. I can't remember who suggested that we should go in there, but we did." David goes on to share that when they're in the dark corner of the lorry park, they both drop their trousers and mutually masturbate and fellate each other. And David remarked that Lupo was unable to sustain an erection. David squats and tries tending to Lupo's failing erection when David became aware that Lupo's focus was on reaching for something behind him. David goes on to state in his statement, quote, "He was no longer touching me with either hand, and then there was a sudden movement and I felt something around my neck. Both his hands were behind my neck, but I could feel something around my neck pressing against the front of it. I put my right hand up and tried to pull whatever it was forward. It felt like some kind of material." I mean, sorry to break away here, but this is the same pattern that he was doing with the men before.
Yeah, it is.
But David's able to tell us that he sensed something wasn't right and that he's struggling, that there's a struggle. Because he says, "As we were struggling, he pushed me onto the floor on my right side and I could feel whatever was around my neck tightening all the time. I tried to pull it away with both hands, but I wasn't able to. I then put my left hand up into his face and started to shout, 'Help!' The next thing I felt was him biting my thumb. I was also aware of him kneeling on my chest. I continued to struggle and shout, and then he punched me in the face and let go of my thumb from his mouth. Whatever had been around my neck became loose and I remember saying to him, 'You won't succeed.' He then suddenly stood up and let go of me. As I got up, I felt something drop from around my neck to the floor. I looked around and saw that he was standing about 8 feet away in the road and looking back at me." David continues to yell for help and Lupo flees. So you see there again, you know, we have testimony now that Lupo is trying to end David's life, it seems, through strangulation, but David puts up a fight. He struggles and he's trying to fight back. Perhaps, as we discussed earlier, just the body's natural reaction. You know, you said that it's that fight or flight kind of mode.
Yeah, it seems to be.
Lupo lashes out. And again, with these men that have all got the bruises. So I can't believe, no matter how drunk they were, that they didn't try to defend themselves.
Or maybe that they didn't actually lash out. Maybe through terror or fear or whatever, they wasn't able to fight back at all.
Could be. But I just can't help but feel that Tate and Wire in this book are trying to portray them, that they knew that this was, they were into S&M and it was, you know, this rough brand of sex, so they deserve it, or, you know, they were expecting to...
Yeah, kind of expected it to happen.
Yeah, that they were going to expect some S&M. So not necessarily why I feel sorry for them, but well, like you said earlier, it's kind of, well, you know, all this debauchery that gay people get up to, then, you know, they can't deserve it, really. They know what's coming.
Yeah.
I think that's what the narrative is that they're pushing in the book, and perhaps
Glee. It's very biased, you know.
Yeah.
It's very biased. And, you know, I kind of don't like, even though I appreciate what they've done, I don't like their style of writing. You know, as you said earlier, they have to create this bit of sensation, this taboo issue around the deaths, because they're saying basically, if they hadn't have been young gay men, this possibly wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. And interestingly, David said he first called the gay switchboard and they told him not to report it, as the police would query what he was doing in the lorry park. And at the time, there was a serious distrust of the police, as you mentioned earlier. Although when the press got wind of this, the gay switchboard denied giving David that advice. What do you think?
I think it's a possibility that the gay switchboard did say that to David, because obviously the whole gay community and the Met didn't really see eye to eye. But I think it's a bit naughty of them to deny that they actually told David to do that. But I suppose that they had to, because they was covering the back.
If they did say that to David.
It wouldn't surprise. If they had said it at the time. But yeah, we'll never know.
Because I think it would be the case of, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the advice would have been, well, you were attacked, but if you go to the police, they'll want to know what you were doing there.
Exactly,
We were having sex. Well, you shouldn't have been doing that, should you? In the police.
It is kind of believable. I am tending to kind of stay on David's side on this one.
And David, aware of the murders, did inform the police eventually. And he also went back to the lorry park to retrieve the long black sock that had been used in an attempt to strangle him. Once retrieved, David took himself to St. Thomas Hospital to tend to his injuries, particularly his thumb. The police at the time had not connected all the above men with being attacked by the same person, Lupo. And with the investigation looking bleak, the police decided 6 days after David Coe's attack and his clear recollection of what his attacker looked like, that they'd take David around the gay pubs and clubs to see if he could spot his attacker. Tate and Wire share the details of this undercover operation in the book, where they state, at 22:15 on Thursday the 15th of May 1986, David Coe was picked up by two plainclothes sergeants and driven to the Prince of Wales pub in Cold Harbour Lane, Brixton. Outside, a backup unit watched and waited as the three men moved through the crowded bars. Then David Coe, in his own words, said, I felt terribly nervous. Fucking hell, I bet he was, no?
Oh, no, yeah.
I spent my time observing customers, but I didn't see the man who attacked me. We then went to two more pubs and I circulated through the bars with two detectives watching me. But still, I could see no sign of the man. One of the detectives suggested that we return to the Prince of Wales. We reached there at about 12:30. I walked around the pub and the dance floor, drinking Perrier water. Oh, how swish. I walked to various points in the pub and observed the customers. It was crowded, with people drinking, standing around, or dancing. After about 20 minutes, I noticed a tall, slim man with dark-coloured hair. He was standing at the bar with a group of two or three people, having previously walked right past me. Oh, it's making me go cold. I immediately recognised him as the man who had attacked me. I felt he was unaware of my presence, but my stomach turned over. Fucking no shit. I wasn't exactly scared, though, because I knew police officers were around me. I went straight over to the other side of the bar and told detectives I had seen the man who had tried to strangle me. I went and stood in front of the man. Oh, David, you've got some balls. About 2 or 3 feet away from him, and said, don't I know you? He said, no, I don't think so. My name is Michele. I'm French and a musician. He offered me his right hand to shake, which I did because I wanted to get the feel of the man's hands and skin. I know the man who attacked me had soft skin. His whole manner whilst talking to me was the same as the man who attacked me. His head was slightly stooped, his manner quiet, and his tone softly spoken. I knew I was looking into the eyes of the man who had tried to kill me.
In the next episode, we learn what happened next and where we delve deeper into the mind of Michele Lupo as the events leading up to the shocking act of murder unfold. Prepare for twists that will leave you questioning not just Michele's actions, but the very nature of justice itself.
This episode is dedicated to the memory of
James George Burns,
Anthony Connolly,
Male Unknown with the Tartan Scarf,
Damien Michael McCloskey,
and the courage shown by the men that came forward having survived an attack:
Kevin McDonough,
Mark Leyland,
and David Nigel Cole.
All of the actual newspaper archives mentioned in this serving are available on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link below in the show notes.
And if you've enjoyed listening to AIDS The Lost Voices, then don't be a shady bitch and show us some love with
a big fat like,
a comment,
a share, as in the link, not as in do you believe in life after love? Oh.
And for fuck's sake, don't forget to
subscribe and follow.